Today, public hearing on House Bill 5059, the Public Employees Retirement System, and we are joined by the agency and the budget management. If you all would introduce yourselves for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Clary, Executive Director of the Public Employee Retirement System, and with me is Steve Delaney, our Deputy Director. I also have in the audience Dave Tyler, our Chief Financial Officer, and Brian DeForest, our Budget Officer.
And I would like to commend the Director. He and I met in my office on Friday and discussed what of his staff should be here. And he asked that we have a minimum complement of staff and keep most of them back in the office in Tigard working. And I appreciate your frugality in arranging to just have the core people that you need here.
Thank you, ma'am.
We are obviously a subcommittee of the subcommittee, by the way, for the record.
Well, I might go on. We've got, of course, Cora Parker, our BAM analyst as well. So we've got all the numbers people here, which is good. Well, first off, happy Valentine's Day and happy Statehood Day. Board Chair Michael Pittman sends his regrets. He would have liked to have been here, but he's traveling back from Scotland where he goes as part of his day job as far as power. I'm looking forward to the next couple of days because I think we've got some exciting things happening at PERS. And I hope that you can share that excitement on our new beginnings here. Last week, I was going around meeting with various legislators, and I was meeting with Senator Atkinson, and I was sharing with him some of the statistical data that I've shared with some of you and we'll go over this morning. And he just stopped me, and he said, "Look at yourself, man. You used to live and breathe in the often bloody arena of natural resources, and now they've turned you into an accountant." and you know, I got to thinking about that over the weekend, and I realized, well, certainly I spent my time at Water Resources. We used some very sophisticated computer modeling and statistical analysis there to calculate water availability and groundwater surface water interactions. Likewise, in my involvement at State Lands, both here in Oregon and in Wyoming, we were involved in some real complex financial analyses and leasing schemes. We were setting state grazing fees and got into smoothing formulas there and minister and loan programs. And I cut my teeth in 8 years in the Wyoming governor's office working on mineral taxation and permanent endowment fund issues. And there, of course, we learned that you've got to set aside money in the booms to get you through the inevitable bust that's going to follow. So I guess when you look at it, I've really been an accountant throughout my career. When you look at our legal billings, you can see that I'm still operating in an arena full of disputes. One of the sayings that kind of followed the water world was from Mark Twain. That was whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. Well, unfortunately, as I found here, whiskey's still for drinking, but retirement's for fighting as well. I met with Senator Johnson on Friday, as she said, and she asked a really excellent question. She said, "What are the three biggest challenges that you're facing up at PERS?" Kind of asking me to look down and pick out the three biggest alligators in the swamp. And I stumbled a little bit, but then it came to me, and I laid out these three challenges. First, integrating the new House Bill 2020 pension plan components. This was the one of the major reform bills passed last session that established the new pension program, the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, also known as OPSERP, and the defined contribution component of that, the individual account program. But our challenge there is trying to integrate both of those new components into our ongoing agency operations and coordinating their implementation with our legacy Tier 1 and Tier 2 pension plan components. Challenge number one. Challenge number two is completing the implementation and configuration of our new House Bill 2020 information technology platform. A system that goes under the name J-Clarity. And we have to complete that by next summer. And at the same time, we're launching our RIMS conversion project. RIMS is the acronym for a Retirement Information Management System. That's our legacy IT computer application, covers our Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, and we're eventually going to migrate completely over onto this new system, the JClarity system. So that's challenge number two. Challenge number three is completing the processing of the record number of retirements that we experienced over the last 18 months, addressing the backlogs associated with that wave of retirements, as well as other accumulated workloads that we were struggling with prior to 1990 or to 2003. And we have to do that while at the same time keeping the doors open, the shelves stocked, and the floor swept for all of our ongoing business. I believe we're working hard. I believe we're making progress on all those fronts. We've certainly are taking the step of trying to better align and better utilize our people, our processes, and our technology. People asked, what's the retirement system do? And I've heard it described, retirement systems, the one in Oregon and across the nations, really have a pretty simple job. They take in data and they take in money. Here in Oregon, we transfer the money to the Oregon Investment Council for investment purposes. We manage the data, and eventually when members retire or withdraw or there's a death, we link the data back up with the money and we make a benefit payment. Sounds like a real simple job. Certainly, if it were that simple, we wouldn't have our own set of statutes that we bind in our own place. But in essence, it really is much like an assembly line from that standpoint.
Madam Chair?
Representative.
Thank you. Could you share with the committee, do you know how much of the PERS retirement money is invested in Oregon, is invested in Oregon businesses to try and create jobs here? It's my understanding it's a very, very small portion. And I know you do not control that, Paul, but I just was wondering if we have a firm number on that.
You'll get a second bite at the apple, Representative, when Treasury comes before us.
Oh, yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, and I think, or Madam Chair, that certainly is a good observation. And I've got some numbers just on our alternative venture plan and private equities. I've got those in my briefcase, but I think if we can work with Treasury to get you the full response. But I'm just looking at our largest stockholdings as of June 30th, 2004. Our second largest stockholding in this fund is Intel Corporation. So certainly when you look at it from the standpoint of the Intels and Nikes and a number of others, we've got some major investments. I know KinderCare was one of the alternative equity investments that they had, but we can get that number for you.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, we've taken this little break for the benefit of the folks that came a little bit late. We're only going to go till 9:55 today. The Senate convenes at 10. And so, with apologies to the agency folks, we'll be out here at 9:55.
No problem, Madam Chair. Well, let's turn to the presentation now. And I'll start on page two there, just kind of give you an outline of what we're going to do over the next 2 days. We'll go through an overview of PERS. We'll talk about our current environment. We'll do kind of a high-level discussion of PERS programs and probably end with our priority list today. And then tomorrow we'll get into more detailed discussion of the operations, talk about our performance measures, talk about our peer benchmarking analysis that we participate in, and also go through our 10% reduction list. Turning to page five, we kind of wanted to start with this basic question of why do we have a statewide public retirement system in the first place? Over the history of our program, we've identified a number of benefits to that. First, here in Oregon, we run a single statewide system. integrated. We cover state and local government. We cover higher education. We cover K through 12 education. And because we operate a single integrated system, it frees all Oregon public employers from the administrative costs and burden of maintaining individual retirement plans. Certainly, we believe it produces economies of scale and can lessen the administrative costs of managing multiple systems. With the Oregon system, we've got great portability for public servants. Someone can be a deputy sheriff down in Klamath County, move to Marion County, and then move over to the coast and still be covered by the same retirement plan. You change jobs without losing benefits, and public employers can gain from being able to hire experienced workers. And we see that movement between state and local government, between K through 12 education, higher education, and so forth. Certainly, in the Oregon system, it allows the legislature to influence public policy, public pension policy, on a statewide basis. Some of the other states that have just got multiplicities of retirement systems, county systems, municipal systems, individual school districts. It's extremely difficult for the state legislature to influence systems that they don't have the kind of control over that they've got over the Oregon PERS system. The defined benefit program that we operate ensures that all long-term public employees have a guaranteed retirement benefit in return for their service, and it helps public employers compete with private industry to hire the best and brightest, which, considering the challenges that we're facing, we need to make sure we do try to hire the best and brightest throughout the public employment system. In terms of some history on PERS, the Social Security Act of 1935 is what helped legitimize government pension plans here in Oregon. We had a task force commission in 1939 that started looking at it. As with any major legislation, it took several sessions in order for it to come to fruition. And in 1945, PERS was created by the Oregon legislature. I believe that the bill was signed into law in the around the middle of April or so, which was in the ending days of what was then the longest session in history. So you can see how things have changed a little bit. But we commenced operation then on July 1, 1946, which I guess will make us 59 years old this July. A little bit of history on the changes, and obviously it's always an evolving system. We added Social Security in 1953. We included some health insurance plans for retirees in 58. We had a major reform in 1967, and also at that time created the Oregon Investment Council, established the Deferred Compensation Program in 91. Tier 2, created in 95, became effective January 1, or for everyone that became employed after in beginning January 1, 1996. And then in 2003, had the PERS reform legislation, the creation of OPSERP and IEP. Again, those are the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan and the Individual Account Program. Another key feature of the 2003 reform legislation was a change in our board. We now have 5 members, dropped from 12, 3 of them from the private sector. Our chair is Mike Pittman, Corporate Director of Human Resources for Scottish Power, and Vice President at PacifiCorp. James Dalton is Vice President for Corporate Development at Tektronix. Eva Kripalani is Vice President, General Counsel, and Corporate Sector Secretary for KinderCare Learning Centers. We've got one state manager who represents public employers, and in her day job is the President of the State Accident Insurance Fund, better known as SAFE, Brenda Rockland. And then our public employee member is Tom Grimsley, a middle school teacher down in the Bethel School District, who's been very active in benefit and insurance programs at the school district level. All appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate, 3-year rotating terms. They are the trustees of the fund. They oversee our budget, they also interact with the Oregon Investment Council, which is the separate entity that actually manages our investments. And interestingly, when I look around at other state and local retirement systems, I think that separation of duties serves Oregon very well. Some of the other systems that have particularly gotten themselves in trouble were people that where they were working both sides of the books. I can tell you from my 7 months on the job, and I spent pretty much my entire career working with boards and commissions. I used to joke that my meetings were my monthly lesson in humility. Well, with this board, it's not a joke. These folks are extremely sharp. They're very dedicated and engaged, and bring a great mix of public and private sector experience to the challenges that this system faces.
I think this is an opportunity to stop for just a second and acknowledge the contributions that Oregonians make in Oregon's system of boards and commissions, where citizens, particularly citizens at this level of private sector involvement, are willing to come and help an agency that I think by many people's admission was struggling, and how lucky Oregon is to have people of this capacity and caliber step forward to help guide you in the agency. And I don't think they get thanked often enough, so this is a chance, I think, for this committee and hopefully the legislature as the budget moves forward to recognize their service.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair, and I'll certainly pass that on to them. I think to a person, they all kind of realize that there was a heck of a lot about this outfit we didn't tell them when they hired on. But they remain committed, and we're hoping that perhaps when we come before you to give our report on our preliminary earnings crediting, that we might be able to get our chair, Mike Pittman, to come so you can meet him as well.
Good, thank you.
The board adopted a new mission statement for the agency back in last year, about January, I think. Some people have said, well, this looks more like a vision statement. It's not where you are today. It's certainly what we aspire to be and want to become as quickly as possible, and that is a well-respected organization that serves our members by enabling informed retirement and health benefits decisions, delivering retirement and health benefits effectively and efficiently. Again, key things being providing readily accessible and accurate information to our members, and then delivering their benefits effectively and efficiently. The board also developed a set of 13 guiding principles, and those are on page 10 and 11. I guess these could be viewed as kind of our qualitative performance measures, if you will, things that we're working hard to do. We are continually, people who have problems with our agency continually point out that we've got some distance to cover on a number of these, but I do think it's great that the board has kind of set out this set of guiding principles, and I think you could sum them all up by saying their aim is for us to have a sustainable retirement system that wears well over time for our members, our employers, and our taxpayers, and if we're able to implement these guiding principles, I think we'll be able to achieve that. I want to spend a little bit of time on our current environment, and I'm on page 13 now. In 2003, PERS faced a multitude of challenges. We had a large unfunded actuarial liability, we had litigation on multiple fronts, and we had internal organizational issues as well. Legislature stepped in, working with the governor and the various stakeholders, and adopted what we call the PERS reform legislation. They created the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, a successor to the Tier 1, Tier 2 program, which is known as a hybrid plan. It includes both a defined benefit and a defined contribution component. All public employees will eventually become OPSERF members as the Tier 1 and Tier 2 membership declines and new workers come on and go under the new pension plan. And I believe that is for everyone who started work after August 29th, 2003. We got close to 16,000 OPSERV members now. We over the next couple of pages, we run through our reform legislation and the key bills. House Bill 2001.
I'm sure. Representative.
Let's go back to your prior comment just a moment ago, because we have 16,000 members that are in the new program, correct? And those are individuals that were not previously employed by the state of Oregon?
Right. Anyone who, well, or if there was a break in service, Madam Chair, Representative Crump, if there was a break in service of more than 6 months, they could have been previously employed, but they'll come back under the new plan.
I'm startled, Madam Chair, by the... I know we had 12,000 state employees retire, was it? Was it
total
PERS retirees, not all state. So these are the 16,000 that are in the new plan are all employees, not just state, correct?
Madam Chair, you're right.
I just somehow the numbers were computing there, and I'm just getting confused. I didn't think we'd hired 16,000 employees since 2003. So, thanks for clarifying that for me.
We've got a total membership of about 160,000 active members, and there's our actuary estimates that we have around a 10% annual turnover. So, we've been running the new program for about 18 months. So, those figures pretty much work out pretty close to that. In terms of legislative provisions, and I think it's important for us to recognize the work of the legislature in 2003, the first bill said we're going to credit 8%, no more, no less, until the Tier 1 rate deficit's been eliminated, and then you've got a reserving requirement as well. The second bill said not only will you... now you won't credit anything if there's a deficit in the account. So initially we would have been capped at 8% with the modifications to House Bill 2001 from House Bill 2003. We actually were prohibited from crediting anything to Tier 1 accounts until we paid off the deficit reserve. We also had a provision in House Bill 2003 that froze the annual cost of living increase for people who retired between April 1, 2000 and April 1, 2004. House Bill 2004 required us to use new actuarial equivalency factors and then put in what we call the look-back provision that said when people retire, we'll perform two different calculations. We'll look at what their account balance is as of the time they retire and apply new actuarial factors to that and then compare that to what it was on July 1, 2003. It's kind of a hold harmless provision, and we're starting now to run some of the numbers on that to get an idea how many people are still going out under the look back. And it's still a sizable proportion of folks that are going out under the retirements.
Madam Speaker.
Representative.
Madam Chair, rather. You used to say Madam Speaker. Sorry. Prophetic, perhaps. But
you've seen one woman in power, you've seen...
Yes, yes. and it's Valentine's Day, so I'm going to leave it at that. Lovely scarf, by the way. I was just wanted to make an interesting note. We are the PERS retirement account has done very well in investment earnings in the last couple of years since the market has come back. In fact, so well, I just did a computation here, $48.7 billion divided by 160,000 enrollees, roughly. Those are just rough numbers.
Madam Chair, Representative Crump, also remember you got the 100,000 retirees.
Also.
Right, right.
So that $48.7 billion then should be
about 310,000.
Should be divided by 310. All right, because I was going to say that computation comes out to 304,000 per enrollee. If you take the 160, that obviously is not correct. So it's 310,000.
310,000 when you add in the retirees and then the inactives that may have a claim on some of that account.
Okay. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
House Bill 2005 is the one that reduced the board from 12 to 5 members. 2020 on the next page is the successor plan that we've been implementing, the new hybrid plan. And then Senate Bill 258 was another part of the reform package. It didn't change different provisions. It tried to provide an inducement for people who were inactive as of January 1, 2000 to withdraw their accounts by giving them 50% extra if they would do that. Page 17, I think, is a key display of what were the estimated savings associated with the 2003 reform legislation. You'll see that the 8% limit on regular account earnings was estimated to save somewhere around $904 million. Now, again, this is over the actuarial period of the account or of the fund. House Bill 2003 had the big dollar figures in it, prohibiting the Tier 1 regular account crediting until the deficit reserve was paid off, had an estimated savings of $4.5 billion. Now, that estimate has come down some. It's still good news because the earnings more than offset the impact of that of the reduction in the savings, but originally it was estimated that it would take us 4 years to pay off the deficit reserve. We had about $1.9 billion in that, and that was at the assumed earnings rate of 8%, and instead we'll be paying that off here in March. Redirecting member contributions, they no longer go into the Tier 1, Tier 2 regular accounts. They go into the individual account program. That had an estimated savings of $1.9 billion. And the COLA freeze that affected those recent retirees saved $415 million. Updating the actuarial equivalency factors had an estimated savings of $1.6 billion. And so for all of that reform legislation, we've been cautioned that it's not really accurate to sum it all up because there's a lot of interaction in there. But the estimates were that it's somewhere in the $8 to $9 billion in savings, and that's again perhaps reduced some because of the fact that we had the excellent earnings and we're going to start crediting Tier 1 accounts again. Senate Bill 258 had an estimated savings of $24 million. The pension obligation bond ballot measure, we wanted to list this on here. That had an estimated savings of about $850 million. The state issued, I believe, about $2 billion in pension obligation bonds and have deposited that money in the account. It's invested. We pull out of that what we call a side account the money on an annual basis to help with their unfunded actuarial liability. I believe because of the excellent investment years, the balance on that side account for the state now is close to $2.5 billion. So they've actually did pretty well. I think those bonds went out at less than 6%. They had to be taxable bonds. And then they're invested, and we had a 22%, 24% year in 2003 and a 14.5% year in 2004. So, so far, a very good option that the state pursued. And then the new retirement plan is the one that, as we go forward, all new public employees are going to go into, and that, they figured, has a $7 billion savings in avoided costs in the future. So obviously you can see a lot of money on the table. And so when there's a lot of money on the table, you can anticipate that there'll be some litigation. And the next page is we just kind of go through the litigation update. City of Eugene versus Public Employee Retirement Board. This was one of the original a case that actually was filed prior to the PERS reform legislation, and probably one of the cases that helped trigger reform legislation. We had several employers and members sue to challenge our policies on actuarial factors, our variable match, and our earnings crediting. The PERS board settled with the employers in February of 2004. We were dismissed as an appellant, but the employers and the members appealed on separate bases, and that case went up in front of the Oregon Supreme Court and was argued in November, and we haven't had a decision on that. We expect that it might get wrapped into the second decision on the second case, and that the second case is what's known as the Strunk case, and that's kind of the combined challenge to the PERS reform legislation, again, dealing with actuarial factors, earnings, and creditings.
Mr. Clary, if I can interrupt you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Back on number one, was the litigation brought unique? And the reason I ask that question is, with a settlement agreement, does that open up a situation in which other employers could come forward with the exact same issue, knowing that you settled?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, as I understand, and I'll let Steve correct me if I'm wrong, I think this involved 9 different employers that appealed the 1999 and crediting decision, and the statute of limitations has run on that for other employers. So this is a settlement just with that particular group of employers. Some pretty large employers.
The reason I ask that question, going further ahead, I see that there's 875 public employers. I'm just curious if there's other potential litigation based upon the issue raised by those several employers.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, again, the statute of limitations has run on those particular crediting decisions, but certainly some of the settlement features and some of the court's decision in this has been reflected into the reform legislation. And so other employers have, I guess you could say, benefited from that effort. But the particular issue that this case brought was around these earlier crediting decisions, and that benefit only goes to those 9 employers. Again, on the major legislation, the Strunk legislation, we had the oral argument before the July 30th, 2004, and I see here we say decision to be issued, and I wrote in sometime, and I put in X. And I can't tell you when X is. I get asked that question quite a bit, but we'll look forward to that decision. The third case involved a federal law challenge to the reform legislation that went in front of the U.S. District Court. They upheld the board and in favor of the reforms. That sense has been appealed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and we expect oral argument in that late this year. Another set of cases, what we call the White and Canby cases. These are employers and members questioning terms on how we settled the City of Eugene litigation. Those were separately filed, one in Multnomah County, one in Marion County. We're trying to get them consolidated into Marion County. So, for judicial
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Back on the Strunk case,
yes.
Should that decision go against the state of Oregon, what would be the cost for the Ways and Means Committee to have to
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, again, the challenge is to a number of these features, so if you flip back onto page 17, you can kind of get an idea if they were to come in and say, okay, you did everything right except the COLA freeze, then the cost would be in this area of $415 million. If they directed us to unwind some of the other legislation, depending on what the components are, it could be higher. And it's hard to say how the court would rule in terms of mandating that unwinding. The board has tried to anticipate some of this with its contingency funds, but it's just really difficult. But I think you can get a sense from this table, if if they come out and you read in the newspaper that they upheld everything except, let's say, the cola freeze, you got an idea of what it is. If they unwind some of the Tier 1 regular account creditings, that's where the big dollars are.
That really helps me. I have not followed this issue perhaps like I should have, and I'm just glad to hear it's not an all or nothing.
Right.
But there are segments.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Right.
Dallas.
Yeah. Paul, if I may, if the court comes out with a decision during this session, is it the board's intention to revise the 05 employer contribution rates as a result of that, or does it expect to take those the court decision into consideration at the next time it would revise rates, which we would expect to be for 07?
Madam Chair, Dallas, again, I think what we'd do is we'd look at what the court ruling was. We'd be talking with, of course, our attorneys and Department of Justice. We'd be talking with the legislature and the governor's office and try to find the most reasonable way to implement it. The board's got some flexibility. They tried to establish contingency funds to help cover some of these, but certainly we recognize the budget climate that we're in, and we do everything we could to smooth the implementation of that.
Thank you. Please continue.
So I'm now on page 20, finishing up the some of the key cases. Here, the Henderson case was a federal case, U.S. Circuit Court. There was an attempt to seek a contempt order against the PERS board for using updated mortality tables in alleged violation of a 1978 court order. That case was dismissed. The judge held the board was within its authority to adopt the updated mortality tables, which it did in the summer of 2003. That also has been appealed to the Ninth Circuit, and we're awaiting opening briefs on that. And then finally, a more recent suit here that challenges Representative Krupp, that issue of the break in service. It reduces the time that a PERS member can be out of PERS cover employment. I believe the old law was you could be out for up to 5 years and come back and still retain the status that you were in. If you went out as a tier member and then became reemployed, you stayed as a tier one member. That complaint's recently been filed, and it's we worked with the complainants and stayed it pending the decision on Strunk. Wanted to run through some statistical information on PERS because I think it's important for people to understand just really how healthy the system is. As Representative Krupp noted, we have had two really good investment years. We now have got close to $49 billion in market value in the PERS fund. That's up from a low of about $31 billion in September 2002. We do have cover 875 public employers, and we've added several in the recent months, some small districts, improvement districts that are formed. And this is kind of this number changes continuously. You've got entities that get absorbed, consolidated, and so you may start with three and end up with one, and you've got others that separate out. So we used to show, I think, 869 or so. So we've had a net gain of at least six there.
So, Clay, what's the process for an organization, say a special district, to make application to become part of the PERS system?
Madam Chair, I've got Steve Delaney up here with me. I told him that for the first 6 months, his job was to handle the hard questions, and mine was to handle the easy questions. I'm now in my seventh month, so his job is to handle the easy questions, mine the hard, but I get to determine what's easy or hard, and I think that's an easy question, so I'm going to have Steve respond.
Madam Chair, the entity would contact PERS by letter, letting us know that they wish to apply and obtain PERS coverage. We would ask for a letter of approval from their governing body. It's then forwarded to our actuary to determine what the employer rate for that new entity would be. They get that information, and that then is their determination as whether they really want to move forward or not once they see that actuarial study and see what the rate will be. If they do agree to that, there's a form they sign, an agreement form that lists through the different provisions of PERS, and that's signed then by their governing body and signed by our board chair.
And so anybody that would be coming in, let's assume that this special district had had employees of some 20-year duration, they would still be coming in under the new 2020 structure of PERS.
That is correct. Under the new provisions of the new statute, employers would come in under the officer plan. They could retain their old plan up to the date they come in. Say they were coming in January 1 of 06. They would retain coverage under their old plan up to January 1, and January 1 of 06 they begin the new coverage under the new plan.
But they would, an employee of long duration would commence the new plan as though they were a new hire.
My apologies. If this is an employer that was already participating in PERS or had PERS employees, no, those people could continue into PERS Tier 1, Tier 2 with, based on agreement with PERS. So if you're a Tier 1 member and you go to an employer and that employer has offered PERS, you get whatever PERS offers, PERS Tier 1, Tier 2 if you have that coverage, or you get OPTRIP if you're a new hire, or an employee that never had coverage previously.
Never had PERS coverage previously, would begin under the new new plan. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think I just signed one where it involved the North Bend Airport down in Coos Bay, and that used to be run by the Port of Coos Bay.
Right, and it's now some authority.
And they formed an airport authority, and they had some Tier 1 members that continue as Tier 1 members with this new employer. Chapter 238, which is our what we call our legacy plan, our PERS plan, we've got 154,600 active members, about 47,000 inactives. We give you a breakdown, Tier 1, 103,000, Tier 2, now almost as large as Tier 1, 99,000 as Tier 1 members retire. Tier 2 is going to be a higher percent. Those two combined, that's a closed system. There's no more people coming into employment that'll be Tier 1 or Tier 2 member. So those numbers are going to decline. You eventually will see a higher proportion of Tier 2 members. And then again, the OPSERP, the 16,000 new public employees. About 100,000 retired members as well, including beneficiaries. We just wanted to show you a breakdown across state, local, and school districts, close to one-third, with heavy on the school districts and local government. The retirement, we wanted to show you, this would be for the 2004 retirements, recognizing that we've got some lag period there in paying those, so those numbers will go up before we close out 2004. And if you look at that, it looks to me like perhaps in the school districts we're a little bit overrepresented there, a little bit higher percent of school districts employees retiring in that group than as a membership as a whole. But again, it's pretty much in proportion to the membership. Average monthly retirement benefit for fiscal year 2004 was $2,346. That works out to about $28,000 per year. We've got about 40,000 members that are eligible to retire. So of that active and inactive total at 200,000, close to 20% of them are currently eligible to retire, and that kind of reflects where we sit with the baby boomers.
This might be a good time to ask you to comment on some of the anomalous retirements at 108% to contrast what your average monthly retirement benefit is for the retirees versus some that were captured in the media.
Right. Well, Madam Chair, any system is going to have some variances, and we certainly have variances within our retirement. And they reflect different things. If you were a member heavily invested in the variable and happened to capture, the lightning in the bottle, if you will, that occurred between 1981 and 1999 and got out at that time or switched your money before it fell way off, chances are you both had your pension and you had wealth creation. And, most systems or retirement systems are really developed more to serve as stable retirement income. But in Oregon's case, and in any case where you'd have a an investment feature, you also have this wealth creation aspect, and we just happen to have a period where some people did a really good job of creating wealth as well as developing their standard pension. I think we had at one time had estimated that we were moving up to what we call a replacement ratio, how much of your final average salary does your retirement benefit cover. We were well over 70%. Just with the pension payments on average, and as you know, we had cases where people were going out at well over 100%, and those could vary. You could have someone who spent their entire career as a teacher's aide or janitorial service or something, maybe made $20,000 a year, just happened to invest it properly in terms of the variable account. If his pension is $26,000 a year, you'd be looking at 130% of final average salary. I know, Steve, we've been working on some of those. Have you got anything that you would like to add there, Steve?
We don't have current numbers yet. What I've explained to a number of legislators have asked, because this is an issue, is that part of the issue for us is cleaning out the data to make sure we're showing you what actually is reflective of the issue. For instance, a member who has worked for 10 years and then leaves for 10 years, they're probably going to retire with 100% of final average salary because their salary was many years ago, and they're getting retirement benefit at a much later date after having a second career at a Fred Meyer or something like that. Those are not the kinds of numbers that we want to present to you because they would not be reflective of what the system produced. How a member chooses to take out their dollars can impact it, those options. So we have to clean out that data. We are working on that. I will say that in the last session, when it came to averages, the average individual that was getting more than 100%, we only had one class that we identified in the 03 session, and those were people with more than 30 years of service and who participated in the variable. So they had two particular factors that came into play.
Senator Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Wasn't there an original directive to the first board that the goal was to achieve X percent of your final salary plus Social Security, translated as a percent of your final salary? And my question is, how much in excess of that are we today?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, if you look at just the defined benefit formula for Tier 1 and Tier 2 members, if that's all we had, we didn't have the wealth creation aspect in this system, in 30 years, you'd go out at 50% of your final average salary, and if Social Security is providing somewhere between 20 and 30%, you'd be up in the 70 to 80%. Most of the studies that I've seen say that if you truly, considering now how long people are living, want to make sure that you're not going to outlive your retirement nest egg, and you're going to be able to absorb some of the increased costs that we're seeing in health care and other general price inflation, you need to be trying to shoot for somewhere between 75 to 85% of your final average salary, combination of your pension, your Social Security, and your private savings. If you think that inflation is going to be 2% a year, you can go in at the 70, 75%. If you think it's going to be 3%, you need to be up at the 85 to 90%. So I think that was probably the original intent, was to get people in that range. I've got some data here. Why don't I pass this out? Thank you, Cora. Because what I found interesting with this is out of our combined annual financial report. I'm not sure whether I got enough copies up there, Dallas, but if you need some more, I've got. And this is this will maybe show for you what Steve was talking about, how it kind of varies depending on your years of service. If you look, we've got the data for retirements between 1995 and 2004 running down the side across the top. We're showing years of credited service, so people who have 0 to 5 years, 6 to 10, and so forth. That last column before the total is the people who have 31 years plus. And you can kind of see where we were starting to there's been some variation, but certainly we were starting to pick up in 2001, 2002, 2003. For that group, we peaked out at about an average of $4,900 for these are your long-term public employees. Drop down now to around 4,400. So, and you can see that across all classes, you had that decline with the 2004. So, you know, you can certainly attribute some of that to the reform legislation, the effect that it's going to have on dampening future retirement benefits. Again, here's where we show this this average for 2004. Was about 28,000 a year. If you look at it across that 10-year period, the average is more in the $21,000-$22,000 a year range.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. On the discussion of retirees who are making more than 100%, I understand the political issue. I'm struggling with the policy issue. From my perspective, if a person is making their monthly contributions and they're astute enough to manage their money in a way that allows them to take advantage of a growing market, I'm trying to see the downside to the taxpayers of Oregon from an astute employee of the state. Can you share with me, or is this a deeper conversation at another time?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think had we not had some structural deficiencies in the program, you wouldn't have had the downside. And you know, I may be a little naive here, and I'll let Steve correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly I think one of the structural deficiencies was that employees were able to put money into the variable, and they could earn at this rate, and the employers' money was not being invested in the variable. So when it came time for someone to retire under the money match, the employer brought in this kind of money, the employees brought in this kind, and this gap had to be filled by the employer. So had it been run a little bit more like, okay, we're putting our money into variable, the employer's putting a match into variable, and then we roll with it, somewhat like a 401k that's got employer match, then I don't think you'd have had that problem. But we had that structural deficiency.
Well, a quick commentary. It's unfortunate that some of our astute public employees had to take the brunt of some of that criticism for doing nothing more than taking a system and intelligently managing it. And that's just my belief on that. Just one last quick question. Would it be possible to get a purse schedule for legislators just to see what a legislator of 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 years would have? I think we do a newsletter, and I think it'd be interesting for constituents to see the wealth created by us.
Madam Chair, if you're, I guess the question would be, can we run this with just using legislators in the database? And I'll might get into some disclosure problems as you start dropping these numbers down some all of a sudden.
Well, if we could just keep it confidential, yeah. I'd just be interested to show my constituents.
Yeah.
How are you going to show your constituents and keep it confidential?
Confidential in terms of what Chair Johnson is doing. If there's a way just to capture a picture of what legislators' retirement benefits look like.
Right. Well, Madam Chair, certainly, Representative Smith, if all you were was a legislator and you, you know, went out under the formula, you know, I'm not sure what the salary is, $14,000 a year or something like that, if that times, you know, 10, 15 years, 12 years times 1.67, you can, you know, the math is there, but it.
How did I understand there were recent retirees, though, that who, if they put in 3 years at a much higher salary rank will then receive a much greater benefit.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we do use the 3 years of highest average salary in doing the calculation.
So in theory then, Madam Chair, you could serve 20 years in the legislature, get a state job at as a director of an agency at a fairly high rate, and all of your prior years would have been counted, frankly, at the higher rate. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, from a formula standpoint, it's correct. Now, if you happen to be in the legislature during the really good 20 years, you still may have come out better under the money match provisions, depending on what the salary differential is. But
we've just seen your retirement planning, Representative.
Well, Madam Chair, I have elected to never participate in PERS because I believe it's a conflict of interest for us to vote on our own retirement plans, and therefore I'm not subject to this conversation in any way.
Would you continue, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next page, we just kind of show where our contributions are going nowadays. Prior to the reform legislation, both employer and member contributions went into the PERS plan. January 1st, all member contributions go into the individual account program, employer into the pension program, or the OPSER program, depending on what employee they're contributing on. The next chart kind of shows why our, despite the PERS reform legislation that we talked about and the savings associated with that, and despite the good investment years that we talked about, why are employer rates going up? And the reason that employer rates are going up right now is we use a four-year smoothing technique, and this is the first valuation that we're really recognizing the significant investment losses of 2001 and 2002, and really the actuarial losses of that entire time period. This is a hole that we dug. And obviously, I think the legislature recognized correctly that the quickest way out of a hole is first quit digging. And so with the reform legislation, we quit digging that hole. But we still have to fill this hole. And from a fair market value basis, this hole represents about $6.2 billion. From an actuarial basis, because we assume everything at 8%, this hole represents about $15 billion. And so that's the hole that we're filling with increased employer contribution rates as we go forward over the next 24-year actuarial period. Now, we're going to fill it with both employer rates and investment returns. And if we do better than 8%, we're going to put a lot of investment returns towards filling that. But the assumption has got to work around that 8%. The next two pages, 26 and 27, kind of contrast where we would have been with employer rates had it not been for reform. That top line is the projection pre-reform. We'd have had employer rates up in 25% of payroll. With the reform legislation, that dropped at about 6% of payroll. Our earlier projection was we wouldn't be up to this rate that we're jumping to right now for 2 years. We actually are going to start a little bit higher, but then fall off. And the reason for that is a lot of the projected savings was it was going to take us 4 years to pay off the deficit reserve for Tier 1 regular accounts before we could start crediting to those accounts. Instead, we're paying them off in about 2 years. A lot of employers, though, like the state of Oregon, made lump sum payments, some with pension obligation bond proceeds, and the chart on 27 shows the effect of those. Drops that rate again another 5% or so, puts it down about 14.5% average. One of the things that I want to make sure people are aware of, because the focus is always on employer rates, and rightfully so, because that's a huge budget issue for us, but when you look at the system, pre-reform versus current conditions, I think the legislature's got to take a lot of pride in what they did, because pre-reform, we were projecting we'd be sitting here with a $15 to $17 billion unfunded liability. Post-reform right now, and we say this is current conditions, and this is actually with the valuation that was just completed that only covers calendar year 2003. We show $6.2 billion in unfunded liability, 1.7, less than 2 with the pension obligation bonds. Actuarial liability to asset, our funded ratio, if you will, we were projecting being down in the 70-80%. Instead, we're 86-96%. Fortune 100 corporations for 2004, their average funded ratio was 84%, so actually doing very well compared to corporate America. Average employer rate projection of 25%, we're at 19 without the side accounts, 14.35 with them. That's if we were to phase that entire rate increase in one step. The board decided to phase that in over two bienniums, so it would be less than that.
Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just can't let this pass without at least a comment recognizing the need for good retirement benefits to attract good people. I think even post-reforms, the benefits so far exceed what the private sector is providing, that this is still a very, very good plan, a very rich plan, comparatively speaking, at least to the norm that I have experienced and my colleagues in the business community. Thank you for that editorial comment.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, the reserving decisions of the board, I think, are worth noting as well. Again, we started with a $1.9 billion deficit reserve. We paid that down to $255 million in 1 year, and we will pay that off in March. We had no contingency reserve. We currently have $788 million in that, and I would anticipate that the board will likely credit more into that account here in March. And then we've got a capital preservation reserve of $433 million. So combined, when you look at that, that was about $3 billion that went into reserves, one to pay off the deficit and two to put things aside. So certainly, I think, again, what this chart shows is how the combination of the reform legislation, the improving market conditions, and the prudent decisions of the new board have greatly enhanced the health of this system and improved its sustainability.
Senator Krupp.
Just briefly, that's $3 billion over the last 2 years, roughly?
Over last year.
Over the last year. Okay, thank you.
This is all out of 2003 earnings. 2004 earnings will be credited here, and we'll have a preliminary crediting in February, and we'll be here at the end of the month.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative
Amaka. This discussion could be a very lengthy one, so keep it really short if it's possible. If the Oregon Supreme Court overturns the reforms, what does that do immediately to the deficit and the reserves that have been built? Does it affect them in any way?
Madam Chair, Representative Avakian, certainly some of the reserves will be able to mitigate some of the impact of that of the court decision. So, again, if we were to put a similar amount in the contingency reserve, we might be sitting on close to $2 billion in reserves that we could help use to mitigate the impacts of the account of the fund. The Tier 1 deficit reserve, I don't believe we'd have any effect there because we were just paying that off. We may have to go back and credit. Last year we gave 0% to Tier 1 accounts. If we were directed to go back and credit those Tier 1 accounts with 8%, there would be a financial effect there.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, the final chart here is just an indication of kind of what we're facing with our the aging of our membership, if you will. You can kind of see the 1975 line is the lowest line, 89, the middle, 2003. And for us, it's just a question of is this wave going to lap up against our shore, or is it going to come in and overwhelm us? We do real well if we can process retirements in the 5,000 to 6,000, 4,000 to 6,000 a year range. If we get hit with another 12 to 15, it kind of overwhelms our system. Just a quick overview of some of our programs. And again, we talk a lot about these. We've got the we've got five basic programs. We are administering the Chapter 238 program, Tier 1, Tier 2, the new retirement plan program, and the defined contribution component of that, retiree insurance program, deferred comp, and Social Security. If you look, I'm on page 32 now. We just line out for you some of the basics of the Chapter 238 program. I think probably important to remember all benefits. The entire operation of this system, as well as the administration of it, is from other funds. The benefits are from a non-limited allocation. We're funded by member employer contributions and investment earnings, with investment earnings being the majority of the money coming into the system, and that's why we get hit so hard when the investment earnings fall off. We haven't had any new employee contributions into Tier 1, Tier 2 since December 31st. Again, goes into the individual account program. We've got multiple benefit options. Average salary of our members for 2003, about $41,000. Very much in the ballpark of average salary, the national average salary. Average annual benefit of our retirees, about $28,000 for 2004. Again, for all our retirees, about $21,000. And again, Senator Morse, I'm not sure how that compares to the average within the private sector. I think there's a number of folks that aren't covered by retirement systems. You bring them in. But
I was going to ask how this tracks against some of the national norms that you're tracking against. When we talked in my office on Friday, you said that you use some measurements comparing Oregon to other states. And I'm just curious, because for a long time there's been this debate about the richness of the PERS package versus Oregon's ability to pay competitive wages. And I think the question still remains in some people's mind about competitive wages versus the benefits conferred by the PERS system.
Right.
And could you comment on that as you're tracking Oregon nationally, norm referenced?
Madam Chair, just from the anecdotal evidence I look at, and I read a series of news clippings every week from around the nation, we're in the same ballpark in terms of the average salary. Actually, there's a number of states that now, with post-reform, are saying that, you know, Oregon is something to model. They're thinking that we got out ahead of a problem that a number of them are starting to experience. But it looks to me, and I remember, you got to compare it based on, you know, apples to apples. So I saw a comparison of 30-year employees making $60,000 a year, what they went out at, and on that, I think it was a six-state comparison. California was the top, Texas was next, Colorado was third, Oregon was fourth, and I can't remember who the other two were. But certainly, while we've got, you know, our anomalies, you know, we're very much in the middle of the pack now.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I appreciate this committee allowing me to ask some 101 questions, because this is new to me. I'm struggling with the fact that the state of Oregon constitutionally can't deficit spend, and if all of a sudden we had an exodus of employees, the state of Oregon would be asked to step up to the table and help figure out how to take care of these individuals. And I'm trying to take that fact and match it up with the fact we still have about a $6 billion unfunded liability. Help me with the legal parameters under which this is operating.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, we use the term unfunded liability, but it's incorporated into our employer rate schedule, and we are going to pay it off over this amortization, this 24-year period. So it's a what we try to do is match the obligation for today's employees to today's taxpayers, and that's how you do it with that amortization. So it's you know, it's basically the way that defined benefit systems operate.
You look perplexed. Did that not answer
your
question?
Yeah, I think it's one of those that if I want to pursue it, I'll just have to call you and go from there. I think it'd take much more than our time allows.
Okay. Thank you.
I'm just struggling with that.
And interesting, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, and I'll get these numbers for you tomorrow. With the pension obligation bond, I think the state of Oregon might actually be almost 100% funded now because of the great earnings that they had on it. Again, this is for the system as a whole. We get this $6.2 billion unfunded liability, but with that pension obligation bond deposit, I think the state of Oregon last figures last year, I think we were 99.6% funded or so.
Okay. Please continue.
The public service retirement plan, again, with those two components, the defined contribution and the pension program, also benefits paid is non-limited. I don't believe we're paying any benefits yet for a retiree out of the public out of the new program. Some different features for that program. You don't have the number of options that you've got for Tier 1, Tier 2. The rates, employer rates, are currently about 8% for general service, about 11.5% for police and fire. Again, this reflects the effort of the legislature to come up with a program that was on a more sustainable basis. Individual count program is now what we call it's kind of our defined contribution feature in this hybrid program. Employee contributions go into that individual count. They buy units. We started last year at $10 a unit. The last value was $11.08. So you've had about a 10.8% return on that. Employers who, again, if you pick up the employee contribution, you have to continue to do that until December 31st and then continue beyond that until you give us written notice as prescribed in statute. This allows for renegotiation of contracts, but the contribution stays in place until those negotiations occur. The individual account program is totally funded by a charge on the participants that's currently $2.37 a month for both PERS and our third-party administrator, City Street. And applies to both PERS and OPSERV members. All of us now that are in the system have this individual account. You've got a little bit different vesting period for it. The charts on 37 and 38 are just kind of a comparison of our plan components. Might highlight a few of the differences. You'll note that under the new pension plan, the retirement age has been raised to 65 under the OPSERV pension. 58 with 30 years. You don't have a member account in the OPSERV program. It's all over into the IAP, and no guarantee associated with that. There's some different treatments of how you dealt with lump sum payments of vacation time. The only one that included it is Tier 1 members. Also some different treatments of disability payments, how we integrate those payments with workers' comp, and those are highlighted on page 38. I think probably a key difference also is the benefit formula factor. Again, this is the factor that we multiply times years of service and the average of the three highest years of salary. For the OPSERV, it's been dropped to 1.5, which would put you out at 45% in 30 years.
Sure. Representative Krupp.
Just to clarify, based on the chart, it used to be that you could utilize your unused sick leave to count into your final year's salary, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Krupp, that is correct. And it's noted there on the page of sick leave. It's one of the second page of the comparison towards the bottom, sick leave, included, and excluded.
It is now excluded under the OR, and it simply isn't available in IEP.
Correct. IEP being the DC plan, so
the DC, right.
Doesn't come
into
play.
Okay. Thank you.
We also operate a retiree health insurance program that we make available for people who weren't able to continue to participate in their plans offered by their last employer. Either they decided not to or they had some kind of a break in service. They worked for a state or local entity and then quit and 5 years later retired. This is, again, totally paid for by members. There are some subsidies associated with it, and we'll go into more detail on that when we talk about the detailed programs tomorrow. We've got about 47,000 members enrolled in the health insurance plan, and we also have a long-term care component of that. In terms of the cost of those health insurance plans to employers, we've got a provision that pays $60 per member per month for Medicare-eligible retirees. Again, these would be people that have met the Medicare-eligible age, which I believe is 65, they get a subsidy of $60 a month to buy supplemental health insurance. I think this is one of the big differences with Oregon's retirement system, and this is where it makes it difficult to compare different plans. There's a number of retirement systems that actually do provide retiree health insurance. And so when you sit and say, well, this system is only paying an average of 60% of their salary replacement ratio, but if they're picking up $800-$900 a month of health insurance for a lot of members, and certainly for the lower paid members, that is a significant benefit. And that, for a number of the systems, they're starting to get into real trouble with that because they're experiencing the same thing that we're experiencing here with PEB, the rise in health care costs. But that is something that I always try to caution people, that if you're going to compare Oregon to another state, remember, we've got pretty limited support for post-employment health insurance. You either pay the full freight, you pay the full freight until you become Medicaid eligible, and then you get this $60 a month. With the exception of this one program that we've got, and there's always exceptions, these are for people that are very difficult to insure, and we've got about 890 participants in that where we do provide some subsidy for pre-Medicare insurance. We run the Deferred Compensation Program, also known as the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, and we use third-party administrator for that and work with State Treasurer on that. I think we've got about 40% participation. This is primarily state employees, but it's also available now for local governments that enroll with us. And then finally, we're the single point of contact for the Social Security Administration coverage, working with employers that want to come into the Social Security system. Program administration on page 43, you can see we administer some of these on our own. With others, we use third-party administrators. The individual account program, we use City Street. The deferred compensation program, we use City Street. And our health insurance programs, we got two different third-party administrators there.
Are those bid out, or how often do you refresh those contracts to make sure that we're getting a good deal?
Madam Chair, they are bid out, and I believe they're probably on about a three-year cycle or so. I know that since I've been here, we bid out the IAP account program was bid out right before I got there, and I think it was combined with the deferred compensation as well. But I'll get you the exact cycle of those. And then finally, to close the day, we've got kind of our priority list. Again, we have gone through these five basic programs.
Mr. Clark, I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair and quit before we get into your priority list. We won't be able to finish, and I just assume start fresh here tomorrow. Note for the committee, we are a little behind if we stop here, and particularly giving up 45 minutes of today. So if everyone would be prompt tomorrow, we'll get right with it. Senator Morse.
Just an unrelated question here, if I may, Madam Chair. The supplemental retirement accounts that have been negotiated by quite a number of school districts, are those affiliated in any way with PERS and the investments or with the Oregon Investment Council?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I'll take a stab at that and then have Steve fill in. But if they were to say, we'll give it to you in the form of deferred compensation, now I'm not sure whether the school districts are part of our savings growth plan or whether they're running it under optional retirement plans. Steve, do you know what those?
I don't know, Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I don't know what the specifics are. Generally, what PERS statute directs is that when there are retirement packages being negotiated, that is not considered PERS coverage salary and is excluded. from the coverage. That's the general principle applied in RFQ.
But they could be using some of their other programs available in education, the TIA-CREF, which is kind of a defined contribution program, or individual 401 accounts.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5059, and we will begin with your prioritization tomorrow at 8:30. Without objection, we are adjourned.